Good morning, or depending on what time you're listening to this special on-demand session, good afternoon or good evening, and welcome to the Publishing Business Virtual Conference and Expo. I'm Brian Howard, Editor-in-Chief of Book Business Magazine, and I am pleased to welcome you to another great session, E-book Pricing and the Department of Justice Case, Does the Consumer Win or Lose? Featuring Molly Bost and Marcelino Elisua. I'm very excited about today's panel, as we've got a pair of speakers with some unique insights on the case and what it means for publishers. Molly is a partner at the Wilmer Hale Law Firm. Prior to that, she served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General for the Antitrust Division of the U.S. Department of Justice and was one of the attorneys who worked on the government's case against Apple and the five major publishers. Marcelino is the founder of Lead Publishing, a business book house with operations in Spain, Mexico, Colombia, Argentina, the United Kingdom, and the United States. He has a master's in international economics from Stanford and wrote a much-publicized letter to the Department of Justice in opposition to its case. Now, before we get started, let me point out a few tips on how to make the most of this presentation. First, if you have any technical difficulties, you can troubleshoot by clicking on the Help button at the bottom of the console, or shoot a quick email to virtualshowinfo@napco.com, and someone will get back to you promptly. Please make sure you turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can utilize all of the widgets and bells and whistles on this console. To know what the widgets on the console do, please click on the Tips for Attendees widget below and learn how you can customize your experience today. You can even tweet right from the console. Lastly, if you leave this session at any time or would like to view it again later, you can access the entire presentation from the auditorium in the PBV on-demand environment, which will be open for 3 months beginning on Monday, September 17th, 2012. So let's get to the session. In April, when the Department of Justice announced it was filing a complaint against Apple and five of the vaunted Big Six publishers, the publishing world was rightly stunned. At the heart of the case was the much-heralded agency model, which the publishers felt helped them regain control of the prices their e-books were being sold for through e-tailers like Amazon. However, the Department of Justice's case alleges that the route publishers took to get to the agency model, and not the agency model itself, was anti-competitive. A call for comments yielded some 800 letters from the public weighing in on the case. Meanwhile, three of the big publishers, Hachette, HarperCollins, and Simon & Schuster, settled. Apple, Penguin, and Macmillan have decided to fight the allegations, and the case is scheduled to go to trial next year. Joining us today are two speakers with some insight on what this all means. Molly Bost will give an overview of the case and offer some observations on what it might mean, and Marcelino Elisua will offer a publisher's perspective and some thoughts on the way forward. To start, I'll give the floor to Molly Bost. Molly, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Brian, and welcome to our audience, wherever you are. I wanted to begin by providing a basic background. Perhaps most of this is known to all of you, but I have the impression from what I've read since this case was filed that there is that much of the commentary isn't focused on what the government has really sought to prove here. So let's start with the complaint filed by the United States. It alleges a horizontal price-fixing conspiracy among Apple and the five major publishers, as Brian said. It alleges that the conspiracy was implemented, not that the agency model was the conspiracy, but rather it was implemented by a switch away from the wholesale retail model to the agency model, which stripped the retailers of pricing freedom and also introduced specific pricing tiers. The complaint alleges that Apple facilitated the conspiracy by entering into new publishing contracts, raising prices, and giving it the vaunted 30% commission. And it further alleges that the publishers, because of the force of this agreement and the Most Favored Nations provision in it, imposed the same terms on all other retailers, and it is alleged that this was implemented by threats to withhold content. From a legal perspective, the government's complaint rests on what we call a hub-and-spoke conspiracy theory. If there were just a series of bilateral agreements between Apple and each of the individual publishers, it probably would not be illegal. It certainly would fall under a different legal framework. So in order to establish a horizontal conspiracy among the publishers, the government has to prove or provide sufficient evidence to persuade the court that there is a rim in this hub-and-spoke arrangement, that is, an agreement among the publishers. The complaint sets out in considerable detail a number of factual averments to support the conspiracy or the rim. It points to the timing of the agency agreements and the prompt price changes thereafter. It points to the price terms of the agreements, like the tiers I mentioned. It points to the need for interdependent action among the publishers. There were allegations that the publishers believed they couldn't go forward with this agency model if their peers did not do the same. It points to, in the highly publicized series of dinners, senior executive communications. Again, as alleged, the conspiracy was reached at the highest levels of these companies. It points to certain efforts to conceal some of the conversations, and it points to assurances provided by Apple that it was implementing the same arrangement with each of publisher's peers. In other words, it alleges that Apple was engaged in shuttling the terms of the conspiracy among the publishers. The complaint goes further and says that the MFN, or Most Favored Nations, provisions in the agency contracts serve to ensure that the publishers could control other retailers' prices, because if they failed to do that, they would violate the Most Favored Nations provision. Again, from a legal perspective, one thing that's notable about the complaint is that the government has alleged that this conspiracy was a so-called per se violation of the antitrust laws. Without wanting to get too legalistic for you, in the antitrust world, we generally divide civil violations into two categories. One is per se, meaning illegal per se, and the second are those that are subject to a rule of reason analysis. In the per se category, the law holds that the government or the plaintiff need not prove anti-competitive effects if the agreement is a horizontal agreement among competitors, and it deals with prices, then anti-competitive effects will be presumed without detailed analysis of the market. But alongside that, the government has also protected itself by alleging a rule of reason case, and in that part of the complaint, they define the market as the market for trade e-books and allege that the price effects of the conspiracy occurred within the trade e-books segment. They specifically note that print books are not substitutes for e-books, and therefore whatever happened to prices on the print book side is not relevant to the analysis. Now, I think as everyone knows, the complaint was filed simultaneously with a partial settlement. Hachette, HarperCollins, and Simon & Schuster agreed to settle with the government while the case goes forward against the other defendants. Again, I think the settlement has been the subject of considerable confusion, although things were clarified quite recently when the court issued its order approving the settlement. The main goal of a government consent decree is to restore the status quo ante from a competitive perspective. It is not a policy instrument. It is simply designed to put in place an injunction that restores competitive conditions in the market alleged. This consent decree imposes a few requirements. First of all, it requires that the publishers terminate their agency contracts with Apple. The contracts allowed termination on 30 days' notice, and therefore that much time is allowed. But since they were terminable essentially at will anyway, they are required to terminate them promptly. It also requires them to terminate retailer contracts that had been affected by the Most Favored Nations provisions. That means simply terminating the contract and rewriting it without the residual effects of the Most Favored Nation provisions. And those are the two key provisions. There are others that I think are probably not worth taking the audience's time for. At this point, with the settlement in place and having been approved by the court, we're really looking ahead at the trial in June of next year, unless the other defendants settle along the way. So I thought just a couple of observations might be useful. But before I do that, let me talk a bit about the what the settlement, other provisions of the settlement that are perhaps going to be part of the ongoing conversation. First of all, the settlement doesn't ban the use of the agency model. It simply says you can't agree to the agency model or agree to have it imposed on retailers through a conspiracy among the publishers. Individually, publishers are free to implement the agency model with anyone. Secondly, there's a sort of cooling-off period that I think has caused some confusion. It prohibits the reinstatement of similar terms for a two-year period. I think this was probably fairly controversial within the antitrust division because it is what we would call a highly regulatory provision, but it is intended to allow the competitive effects of the alleged conspiracy to dissipate before the market returns to use of these terms. And the settlement obviously prohibits future horizontal agreements of the same ilk. And it contains a specific provision. These have become more common in recent years in the division's consent decrees, requiring that there be no retaliation, because one of the problems in antitrust enforcement generally is that sometimes the putative victims of conspiracies are afraid to come forward. Therefore, the government feels a need to find a way to protect them. So going to the observations, I said I would offer. The first thing is that the government doesn't seem to have direct evidence of an agreement among publishers. There is a small allegation in the complaint suggesting that, but there's no smoking gun. There's nothing as straightforward as a statement that says, at the dinner at Picholine, publisher X agreed with publisher Y to do the following. That is the reason I went through the various averments that the government has made. What they have done there is try to collect the kinds of information that under the law permits courts or fact finders to infer the existence of the agreement. And the law allows that because it's very difficult to detect some antitrust conspiracies. Clearly, the government, however, seems convinced that an agreement was reached. At the time these slides were drafted, the motion for approval of the settlement was pending. That has now been resolved with the court approving the settlement under the highly deferential standard that is afforded the government in these cases. But leading into the approval of the settlement, there was a public comment period in which over 800 comments were filed, and there were vociferous objections both to the terms of the settlement and to the government's case as a whole. Many of them, I think, not really directed to the allegations, which is the reason I wanted to spend a little time focusing people on what the case is really about. Separately, Apple had also objected to interference with its contractual relationships, basically asserting that its due process rights were being violated by the requirement that the publishers terminate their agreements with Apple. The court has now also ruled on that and said since the contracts allowed termination on 30 days notice anyway, imposing this requirement doesn't infringe on Apple's rights. I think one thing that will happen now that the settlement is going to start to take effect is that the government will be watching this marketplace very closely. It is now in litigation with Apple and the two remaining publishers, and it will want to see what happens and whether marketplace activity and price effects take place that will support its case 9 months from now when it goes to trial. And I suspect that that doesn't mean everybody is under the antitrust microscope. It just means the case will continue to garner the significant attention that it has. And Brian, with that, I will turn it back to you.
Thanks so much, Molly. That was very informative and cleared some things up for me. there's been a lot written about this case, and it's a lot said in the press, and it's nice to have that that perspective on it. And now I'd like to turn things over to Marcelino, who will present from a publisher's perspective. Marcelino, the floor is yours.
Hi to all of you. I hope I can contribute with some original thinking and offer you ideas that will help you to move forward in this publishing world. I may offer you an international perspective based on my 30 years as an author and 19 as publisher. Of course, it's true that some of my experience is limited because we are publishers of business books, mainly in Spanish, but we have been publishing in English in the last 3 years, and I hope some of my thinking can be general and useful for you. We are going to cover first what are the differences between books and e-books and how they affect to the market. Second, more about the e-book pricing and how this affects consumers and publishers, because I think that Mollis has done a very good job and about explaining the whole settlement, and the order of Judge Cotten is quite clear about it. We have to look at how this international market will evolve, because now we are in a global world, and why we are here and how do we get out of here. What are the options available for American publishers? And I will be talking a little more in detail about one of these options, which is to use specialized e-tailers, because I believe it's a very original one and a very helpful one. So coming now into the physical world, in the paper books, we all know that the space in the bookstores was very scarce because they could hold only a few thousand books. So the competitive advantage was to have a good distribution capacity and to be able to get hold of that space. This, of course, led to big publishing houses with many different lines because the size was giving them this distribution capacity. The actual product sold was the book itself, and the pricing of those books was very often based on just looking at similar products in other catalogs, or sometimes even looking at the unit cost and multiplying by a certain number that was typical from one publisher. Now, we are in a different market with e-books because there are many, many books. There is no problem in finding 3 million e-books. Now, what is really scarce is the ability to gain recognition, to be able to bring the attention of the consumer to, let's say, to your Bible, because before it was a job of getting 3 or 4 different titles of Bibles in a given bookstore, but now you have 3,000 Bibles, and the problem is how to bring the attention of that reader to your own Bible. Then the competitive advantage is digital marketing, and that I presume that will lead to specialized houses that will know better who are their readers. So we are changing from big houses to specialized houses, and this is very important. Now we are looking at e-books that are black and white, but this is similar to the state where we were with silent movies. They were also black and white. But I believe that in the future we will see enhanced e-book with color, with sound, and this means that the actual product sold will be much more audiovisual than pure text. And probably we will be seeing a lot of value-added extensions to the book itself. Now, a very important thought about pricing, because if you don't have a variable cost and you don't have a base where to use this multiple that you were used to use, then you are a little bit lost. And especially if there are no history of prices for a given kind of books, then I think that publishers didn't know if the right price for the book was $3 or $9 or $20, especially because at that stage they were making most of the profits with the paper books and the e-books was kind of a marginal sale. But moving to a world where most of the books will be digital, then there is a very important consideration here about what should be the right price. Let me just summarize that probably an American publisher will be much better if they can work together with specialized retailers that allow them to do joint digital marketing, because they will keep a closer contact with their clients and they can use this digital marketing capacity that will be the key one in the future. But also probably they need to work with other publishers to extend the line, to be able to bring more different products. Okay, let's go into ebook pricing. The question is, who should set the final price to the reader? And there are people that believe it should be the publishers through the agency model, and people that believe that should be the retailer through the reseller model. But let's look at what's the thinking what's the thinking below what a publisher does and what a retailer does, because it's completely different. Publisher looks at the title itself, compares it with another titles, looks at the author and the context, and then sets a price that maximizes for him the value of that title. Let's say that maximizes the sales of that title. But if you look at the way a retailer does it, they don't know anything about the content of the title. They just look at the book as an ISBN number and compare the price of that ISBN item in one retailer or in another and look at their actual sales, and then they decide the price, not to maximize the total sales of the title, but to maximize the sales going through his channel, because this is what he's interested in. So the question becomes, why, instead of letting the market decide who sets the prices, the department has to decide about a certain model or a different model? This is something that I don't really believe it's good. Now, what are the actions that an American publisher could take? Choose only agency retailers? Well, this is not easy, because there are Apple and a few others, and then you will be losing a lot of sales that go now through reseller retailers. But perhaps if this is what it's good for you in the long term, this is something that you have to do, and it will help other people to remain there. You can also do other things, like, for example, work, of course, within the law, closer to specialized retailers that allow you to keep the contact with the client, with the final client, that they think that that final client is not only a client of them, but also a client of the publisher. You can try to have value-added propositions for the readers, so that out of a given book, you generate more revenue through other sources or products or services. And of course, you can start using the prices on a much more effective way, because we saw before that prices in the physical world were difficult to move, but prices in the new world are very easy to move. And for example, one thing that we do is always, when we launch a book during the first day, we have it at a very low price, and then we just increase it. If we go into little more in detail, we can see that normally the gross margin with the agency model is higher than with the reseller model, because the discount that you are giving, 30%, is lower than the 45%. So unless you really believe that your sales are going to be much lower, perhaps the agency model in general will be better. Also, you have to be aware that the price elasticity is very high between retailers. So a given reader will go for one given title to one retailer or another because of the price, but it will not move from one title to another because of the price. I think that content and the image of the publisher and the author are much more important there. Also, when thinking about moving into agency, you don't have to think that you will be losing all your sales that go now through reseller, because perhaps there are more agency retailers in the future, and some readers will move into a given retailer that gives them a better service. Something that is important is to realize that the cost, the variable cost of a retailer with paper books was very high, let's say 30%, 40%. But with ebooks, it's very low. It's in the range of 3-5%. So at least theoretically, we should be moving to a discount of around 8-10% that will give enough return on investment to the retailers. If we are not moving to this range of discounts, then there is something we have to think about, because really the variable cost justifies that the margin shouldn't be bigger than that. Also, I think that with the agency model, a publisher can decide to have much more different prices at different times. Remember that with paper books, you have to go from, let's say, a hardback to a paperback to decrease the price. But here you can decrease the price, or in general change the price, by just changing it in 4 or 5 computers. So it's much easier to change the price. So I think that with the reseller model, if at the end it's the one that is general in the market, we will be going through a very strong oligopoly. And that probably will mean that the final price that the consumer pay will be higher. This is something that we have to keep in mind in terms of price, but more important than that, I would say that we have to defend the freedom of press and the capacity to seek original and diverse content. And this is much more easily to get if you have a lot of publishers, a lot of authors, a lot of retailers, and it will be much more difficult to get if you only have a few retailers, a few publishers, or a few authors. So I have moved very quickly, because I think this is more or less well known by everyone, and then I go into globalization. And we know that the reason for it is that there is a very low variable cost to produce an e-book, or there is almost nothing. The total investment is much lower. The distribution is easy to get, because there are a few retailers here and there. And, of course, the cash recovery is much easier. So it means the market will be much more international. The barriers to entry will be lower, and this means that the book in English can be sold everywhere easily. Of course, that will mean that selling translation rights will be much more difficult, because imagine that in Indonesia the books in English are easy to get. Then probably nobody wants to translate it into Indonesian. Then there are also some other consequences for American publishers, is that probably foreign publishers will start selling English translations of their own books in the States. And also, people like us will set up in the States to attract U.S. authors and to offer good PR services. remember that we were talking about full services publishing companies, but really at the end, American publishers are cutting costs and deciding that the editorial is done elsewhere, that the PR is done elsewhere. So at the end, really, the value added by the publisher is lower and lower. So what are the potential actions for an American publisher in a global world? Well, to really work more with international publishers and to be more aware of what's going on in other countries. Why are we here? Looking at it from the Amazon's point of view. Well, of course, they had a huge success in selling paper books based on two things, a very wide range, and second, because the biggest drawback of e-tailing, that was the shipping cost, they turned it into an advantage, and they turned it into a weapon to gain a higher loyalty, because they were able to launch all included shipping fees. So readers, once they have paid a certain fee, they were willing to buy more and more books from us, from Amazon, because the marginal cost of buying one extra book was nothing. But in terms of e-books, this is not so relevant, because as we saw, getting a complete range of books, it's quite easy for an e-tailer, and then there are no shipping costs. So this is the reason why Amazon needed to develop a new loyalty scheme and launched the Kindle, and also decided to reduce prices, because the lower prices allow the company to outgrow potential competitors and to really consolidate a virtual monopoly. Of course, they are also trying to develop content that will be available mainly through them, either through their imprints or exclusive deals. I do believe there that the biggest mistake that the publishers did was to give Amazon the same discounts in e-books that the discounts they were giving them in paper books, because the economics are completely different. In fact, when the music and the video games industry discussed with Apple the discounts, and Apple forced them to a 30% discount or commission, that was regarded by those industries as very high, because remember, again, that the variable cost is only 3 to 5%. So how do we get out of here? I don't really think that Amazon is going to change, but probably the value of a proprietary device will be lower and lower in the future if better devices are done by other players. I don't think that Apple will change, but of course it will be difficult to compete for them if their prices are much higher than the prices in Amazon. Though of course they can trust that they have a very good device. And Google could change, but probably they are going to offer new devices and follow more or less the Amazon road. So we cannot expect big changes there. So what can we do? I mean, we really have to trust on our own forces. I believe that to use friendly specialized retailers will help. There are companies like All in Romance Books or Blue Bottle Books that is specialized in business books that will provide a shopping experience for the readers that is much more meaningful to them, because it's not only information about the e-books themselves, but it's about seminars or other things that could interest to those readers. So by having a shopping experience that is more relevant for the readers in a specific segment, perhaps these shops will move forward. And perhaps they are willing to do a joint digital marketing. So this is something we have to keep in mind. I also would recommend a publisher to stress more the direct sale of e-books, because it's very easy to do, And if you are doing digital marketing, why are you going to drive the readers to other retailers? Become a retailer yourself. You can also develop value-added products and change your prices. I mean, promote your prices much faster and, of course, be in contact with your clients. I think this is something that you always have to keep in mind. Let me focus now very briefly on Blue Bottle Books, which is an e-tailer specialized in business books. In this case, what they offer is a 30% discount, and to keep the price that the publisher is recommending, or the normal reseller model in which the price will be moved. But it's important that they will be providing information that is relevant to the publisher for free, and they will be doing marketing campaigns also for free, not asking for extra money. So, in summary, I think that this kind of specialized retailers will be a good solution. And I really thank you very much for having helped me. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Marcelino, and thanks to Molly. Those were both incredibly informative and interesting presentations, but we're not letting you off the hook just yet. We prepared some questions for you, and on the line with us today is Lynn Rosen, who is the content director of Book Business Magazine as well as the Publishing Business Virtual Conference, and she may jump in with some questions during this part as well. Hello, Lynn.
Hello, Brian.
So let me start off with a question for Molly. Now, I know you can't speculate on the results of the case, but can you spell out in sort of broad terms what could happen from a procedural standpoint if the ruling went against Apple and the publishers? Are we talking jails, fines, waterboarding? If there are a number of possibilities, that's fine. I think publishers just want to know what to expect when the case is decided.
Well, Brian, first of all, let me say that I'm glad you are not in charge of antitrust enforcement because the penalties you suggest are significantly more severe than what is at issue in this case. When I spoke earlier about the difference between the per se rule and the rule of reason, one thing I neglected to mention is that the antitrust laws do encompass criminal enforcement. Those are hardcore cartel price-fixing offenses. This case is brought as a civil case, although it alleges a per se violation. In the criminal world, the fines and jail time are available. In the civil world, the Department of Justice almost always sues merely for injunctive relief, and one could quite fairly, I think, expect the terms of an injunction that they might want against at least the remaining publishers to look very similar to the terms of the consent decree that was entered by the three settling defendants. With Apple, I think it would still be an injunctive case, and the injunction would put some constraints on their contracting practices in all likelihood if they were to lose. The government does have the ability in the antitrust sphere to seek disgorgement of ill-gotten gains. It is a remedy that is rarely used. It actually, there's only one case in which it's been used by the antitrust division, and that was a case that I handled when I was in the government. So I would think that would be unlikely here. I think there, while the government clearly believes there was an antitrust violation here, it also recognizes that this is an industry that's in tremendous flux. I don't think we'd have any interest in being particularly punitive.
Okay. How long will this play out? Will it happen all at once or in stages? And is there an appeal process? When will we know what the final verdict is?
Well, assuming there's no settlement along the way, which is again always a possibility, I think that the trial, if it goes on time, is going to last a few weeks, probably no more than that, and the decision would probably be rendered relatively quickly. You can tell from reading the court's decision approving the settlement that she is pretty up to speed. And this will be a bench trial. It won't be a jury trial. So I doubt we will be looking at too many weeks after the trial concludes. If it's a June trial, let's just rough justice say a couple of months later there's a decision. And if she rules in favor of the government and puts an injunction in place, it'll should take effect right away.
Okay.
And she might allow a bit of a window for implementation, if you will, and obviously everyone needs to be respectful of existing contractual terms. There well could be an appeal, because of the nature of this case, where it's looking as this is one of the reasons I mentioned that it doesn't appear that the government has smoking gun direct evidence of the agreement. The litigation on appeal could be around the sufficiency of the evidence to allow inference of an agreement, but the injunction in most instances is not stayed during an appeal. In order to get a stay of an injunction, you must make an application first to the lower court and then to the appellate court saying you shouldn't disturb the status quo while the appeal is pending. Hard to predict where that would come up.
Okay. Now, has there ever been a case comparable in size and scope to this in book publishing, or is this a unique instance?
I am hesitating because I'm unable to think of one. But I think we should be clear here. This is a case that's captured, obviously, enormous attention, or I wouldn't be here speaking with all of you. but in a way, it's a narrow case. I mean, it's an important segment that is undergoing transition. The government moved because they believed that the transition to a digital world was being thwarted by the alleged conspiracy. We've seen this in other industries, as Marcelino noted. Music was the most obvious example, and I think there's no doubt that the publishers were watching what had happened in that world as well and weren't so happy with the outcome. But I do think, in legal terms, it just says that there are five people who agreed on something, and they shouldn't have agreed on it. They're not attacking the business practices. So in that respect, it's a narrow case.
Okay. There have been some people who have said things along the lines that, what Apple and the publishers are alleged to have done produced a result that, according to some observers, even if illegal, was beneficial to most of the properties involved except for the 800-pound gorilla in the case. What is your answer to that, what's the way to reconcile that?
Well, the government isn't going to choose sides in a battle between an Amazon and the publishers or an Apple and the publishers. It is going to choose the side of the customer.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, again, I think where a lot of the commentary has gone off track. The court actually addresses this sort of obliquely in her decision. She notes that the government said, we understand that people think that Amazon has engaged in predatory pricing, and that it may seek to raise prices later as it continues to gain market share. We took a hard look at that, and we did not find any evidence to support it. They're basically saying, we understand what the battleground looks like here. We are examining all the complaints that have been brought to our attention. We sued on the one where we believed there was a violation, but we did that because we think customers were harmed. It's not because we think one or the other of these sides is right. And, of course, in terms of the practice being beneficial, again, if the conspiracy is what makes it beneficial, then it's just like every other price-fixing conspiracy, but it harms consumers. If it's the practice, the agency model, that's beneficial, folks, after this cooling-off period, are free to go about using it.
Okay.
Can I just jump in with a quick follow-up question to that, Brian?
Sure,
For Molly. Molly, you explained that the per se aspect of this means that the government doesn't have to prove the anti-competitive effects, and you're talking about harm to consumers. And when I read the brief, I wondered, is there, in fact, any evidence of harm to consumers?
You're testing my memory now, Lynn. I believe the complaint does allege that there were price increases. We know that there were price changes. I mean, they talk about the implementation of the pricing tiers and the fact that the other publishers were essentially forced to go along with that in implementation of the pricing tiers would be a price effect. So I think the government thinks it is in a position to prove those effects. The point about the per se rule is that if, let's pick widgets. If five widget makers, this is the law school term, widgets is everything you ever talk about in law school, sat around the table and said, yes, we're all going to raise our prices. We control this market and we're going to all raise our prices 20%. There would be no question in most people's mind that whether they got away with 20% or 10% or even 2%, it would be illegal.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm going to direct a couple questions to Marcelino now. Marcelino, you, Lid Publishing, sells print books through Amazon, but not e-books. That is correct?
That's right.
Now, and you mentioned that you are working with some specialty e-tailers. Now, it seems that selling through niche e-tailers who are open to publisher-friendly pricing could be a good model for niche publishers like yourself. How might a more general interest trade publisher take advantage of that model?
Well, I think there are two answers. One is to become 100 times a niche player, but probably this is not easy because when we are talking about a niche player is someone that really goes very deep in terms of assortment and knowing the authors and the readers. So probably they cannot do that, or at least if they do it for four or five niches, they are not using their size as the competitive advantage, as we saw. So probably I would recommend that they do other things. I could think now of at least three. One will be to sell net, establish net price, and don't use list prices. Or if they use list prices, give exactly the same discount to everyone and not save in the small guys, but try to keep them competitive. I think that one has to invest in getting diversified channels and don't try to save in the small retailers, really support them. Second, if I were a big publisher, I will hire a company, and if there is no such a company, I will try to get it established, that will monitor the prices and will buy huge quantities of an e-book as soon as that e-book is below my cost price. There are no logistic costs, and it will be a good measure to stop any retailer of selling under cost. And the third thing I could think of now is to try to establish or to use a logistics company that will sell the e-books at, let's say, 3, 5, 8, 10 percent margin if this is what it really costs them. It's like using Federal Express. You don't need to have a retailer there. I mean, if retailers are trying to disintermediate the publishers, you as a publisher should be trying to disintermediate the retailers. This is the beauty of the free markets, is that one can compete on whatever terms they want to compete. And you were telling me about Amazon. Yes, I mean, we are very happy of not selling e-books through Amazon. Of course, we recognize that we are losing some sales. We have complaints from some authors that they want to be in Amazon. We try to explain to them why we are not in Amazon, because we give a stronger value to know what are our final consumers and being able to reach them and being able to sell to them seminars or other products that are even more important than the book. But again, I think that one has to build their company trying to get diversified channels, diversified markets, Let me tell you a story from Akio Morita, the founder of Sony. When a big U.S. department store asked for a quote for 100 transistors, he gave a price. Then for 1,000, he gave a slightly lower price. And then the department store asked for 10,000 units, and the price was much higher. And the store say, how is that? And Akio Morita say, because I don't want to be in your hands. I want to have a company that is profitable and that we grow little by little. So probably sometimes sales is not the only factor that you have to keep in mind.
Okay. One last question, because we have to wrap this up soon, but who needs to worry about the ramifications of this case and who doesn't? And this is, I can open this up to both of you if you'd like to jump in on this.
I'm hesitating. But by ramifications, you mean the injunction, or
yeah. Or the result of the case? Yeah.
I guess first of all, let me say one thing that I've neglected to mention when you asked me about what the likely remedies would be, and that is there is private litigation pending based on the same set of facts, and that is on. It may be on a different timetable. I'm not intimately familiar with the docket, whether it's to be tried at the same time as the government's case or not. But that case is clearly a case in which damages will be sought. And I have a recollection that some of the publishers have also settled on a monetary basis with certain state attorneys general. So I was just focusing on the government's case. Look, my view of this is that there's clearly this factual dispute about whether there was an agreement with the non-settling parties, Apple and the two publishers, hotly contesting this key point in the government's case. So without a view on the merits at all, I still think that all that is at stake here, because there may be some changes in terms to allow this cooling off period as we see in the consent decree, but after that it's back to competition as usual if the government wins, and I don't really see anyone needing to worry about it at all as long as they're not afraid to compete.
Okay. Well, I think that will just about do it for the time here. I want to thank both of you for taking part, and I want to thank all of our audience for listening in. On behalf of Book Business, I want to thank you again for viewing the session. If you're interested in discussing anything that you heard during this presentation, we encourage you to visit the Networking Lounge to live chat with other session attendees, and you can also visit the info booth to fill out our show survey and let us know about your experience today. Please check out the agenda for the rest of the day today. We have several wonderful sessions lined up and encourage you to view as many as you can. Remember, if you can't watch them live, add them to your briefcase and view at your convenience in the on-demand environment. Have a great day, everyone.